Welcome to the Product Podcast by Product School. Here's a preview of today's talk.
There was a new movie from Disney called Moana. My Italian product manager way of thinking said, there is no way, is there any Italian here? Right, okay, so you know what possible what I'm talking about, right? Okay, I said, there is no way this thing is going to be in Italy called Moana. They have to change it, and it's Disney, so they know they have to change it. In Italy, usually because we dubbed all the film, all the movies arrive to the big screen a couple of months after they are released in the UK or in the US, right? So a couple of months after, the movie in Italy was Oceania. Why? Moana is not a very common name in Italy. It's not very common. But it was very famous in the 90s because there was the most famous porn star called Moana. I'm not kidding you not. Like, you know, it's, and possibly it's the only Moana that 99% of the Italians know. Not because everybody was watching porn movies in Italy, but because she was invited to talk shows. She was a very, you know, brilliant personality. She was famous, and it was, you know, significant in the life culture of Italians. You can't possibly call a movie for kids Moana, so they have to change it. They have to localize that to be something which was suitable.
In this podcast, we teach our listeners valuable lessons about product management and transform them into thinking like a product manager. We teach product management, coding, data analytics, and blockchain in 14 campuses worldwide, including San Francisco, New York, and Seattle. You can find more information at productschool.com. Join our Slack community of 25,000 professionals to network and stay tuned for our upcoming events.
So let me tell you a little bit of who I am and what I do and why I'm here to talk about international product management. I was born in Italy, and that's where I'm from, and that's where I studied for many years. And I had a master's degree in the University in Sicily in electronics engineering. And it was nothing to do with product management. At that time, I was not really thinking about a career in the digital space at all. And in fact, my first job, real job experience was at Siemens, and I was working in a team of doing research and development on things that if I go through it today and I try and read what I wrote that time, I can't understand the thing. It looks so complicated to me, not so many years after I did write that one. It was a very successful year, and I managed to actually go through a full year of research. We implemented something. I got a patent, international patent recognized for that, but I didn't like it. I didn't like the feeling I had with what I was doing. I was not interacting with people. I was mostly interacting with my computer and with the MATLAB, which is a software most simulation that I used to do at that time. So I didn't enjoy it. So it was successful, but I didn't like it. So I decided to move on, and I started working for a consulting company called Reply. Mainly based in Italy, but actually they do have offices also in London and internationally in Germany and in other countries in Europe. And they essentially do any type of like digital or technology consulting for third parties. And one of the third parties was Vodafone Italy. And so I started working through Reply for Vodafone Italy, but still in Italy. So up until now, there is nothing international there. I was basically speaking Italian. I was reading a few documentation in English, but that was as much as my international point of view was going through. At some point, I was getting bored, and so my boss at the time understood that possibly I was thinking of leaving the company. So, why don't you move into a different project? We have a project which is international. So, okay, what does it mean? So you need to go to Germany, and you need to start working for Vodafone Group, but in Germany, no longer in Italy. And that's where I started, basically kind of traveling and working in something which was much more international than what I was doing before. I spent almost 8 years in Vodafone between consulting and directly there, mainly working on digital content services. So the telcos in general, they have core services like voice, data, text messages at that time. And then you have additional services called value-added services. And this is how they do retention. This is how they think, oh, Vodafone is better than O2, and Three is better than O2, and all these bits. And they compete quite a lot in this kind of things, right? So it was the beginning of the smartphone era. So there was no something like the Google Play Store at that time. So we started building something similar to the Google Play Store, which wasn't available on anything which wasn't the first or the second iPhone. So we tried to build something relatively successful because it was only for Vodafone users. So the proposition was not really available to all the users, but only to a certain group of users. But that was the core message from Vodafone. If you want this, you need to be a Vodafone customer. The propositions, that was a proposition for apps, games, music, digital content, streaming, downloading, videos, whatever. It was a product available in multiple geographies. So it wasn't just a product available in one country only. It was available in multiple countries in Europe. So we had to deal about the product management of this product available in multiple countries. In the meantime, I moved to London. After a couple of years, I left Vodafone. I joined Samsung Electronics. And the Samsung Electronics business in the region is, he was at that time in a team pretty similar to what I used to do at Vodafone, still digital content. Samsung has a strong presence, obviously, as a phone manufacturer, and they have like a digital store where you can download contents. And once again, the proposition was available in multiple markets in the region. After a couple of years, they asked me to join product management for Samsung Pay. Samsung Pay, for those who don't know, Samsung Pay is a digital wallet proposition. So essentially, it allows you to enroll your debit or credit cards into your Samsung device, and you can use the contactless capabilities of the device to make payments like you will do with a credit card, with a debit card, or with Apple Pay if you're using an Apple device, right? I was in charge of product management for the whole region, and we launched the product in six countries, plus we actually had a few discussions with people in Poland. And then in February this year, I joined MasterCard. So MasterCard, the role is much, much broader in this case, although the current project I'm working on is possibly mainly UK-focused, but my remit is definitely regional. And in this case, region includes Russia, which sometimes is left over the European remit, sometimes is in this case is in. And so I moved into the digital financial services space since a couple of years, since I started in Samsung Pay. So this is how my experience as a product manager became international, because I was looking after product which were spread across different territories in the region. But let's try to understand what does it mean to be a product manager and what does it mean to be an international product manager. So the question sometimes is like, what does a product manager do? What is a product manager? And, if you go by the book, sometimes you feel this definition. Product managers are the interface between various functions and play a key role in bridging technical and non-technical internal and external teams. Fine, okay, it's all right. I mean, it's factual. That is what a product manager would do. And you have like, sometimes you feel like overwhelmed by the number of people who try to interact with the product manager, trying to understand what the product is all about, what is the product going to do, when are we going live, can we go live, can we not go live, can we postpone this, can we build this, can we do this on top of this? And that's the reality. Product managers, in most occasions, they bridge the whole organization around that product because they are knowledgeable. And not to the extent of knowing all the bits of the product, because that's where you have to go a little bit more into technical details with the developers. In fact, usually engineers and developers are the best friends of the product managers. But still, you need to be able to speak different languages depending on who in the organization you're talking to. So it is really a quite relevant job. And, whenever I was in between jobs, I was looking for a different role. That is one of the definitions that normally fits in the description of a product management role. This is what you will possibly see in a CV of a product manager. And you try because as a candidate, you want to shine. You want to tell everybody that you have been doing a lot of things. And you want to say, oh, I was talking to legal, I was talking to finance, I was talking to the testing guys, I was talking to the developer service. But everybody knows that you are talking to all these teams, because in that role, you have to talk to all these teams. So does it apply to international product managers? Yes, obviously it does. And even more so, because you need to multiply this possibly for a number of countries that you're talking to. And every single country, most occasions, you have that structure within the theme, and you need to interact, in most cases, with some of these people, once again, based in different locations. So in this space, sometimes you feel a little bit like, as a product manager, you feel like, oh, wow, everybody has questions for you. Everybody is waiting for an answer for you. And once you answer the first question, there is another question, there is another question, and there is another question. And you try to fix problems, and you try to solve another question. And say, wow, you feel kind of empowered to be the one who knows all the bits of the implementation, and you feel proud of it. And you say, well, I'm making friends here. So if I'm going to be the one with questions, and I need somebody to answer these questions, possibly because there is no way I can move forward without that answer, I will have some of these guys next to me, supporting me. That's how you end up usually. And that's you. You have your problems and people just disappear. Usually after 5 o'clock, people disappear from the office and you are left there alone and say, fine, now I can start working. But you need friends. You need to have somebody you can talk to. We will see in a bit, it's not that bad. There are situations, and it's up to you to understand who are the people you need to link to, because at the end of the day, you are not alone in that team. You need to be able to link with somebody who is going to be able to give you insights or suggestions, recommendations on things you have to do. But sometimes that's the feeling you have as a product manager. The question is, what makes a product manager international? Well, clearly, it's not about the manager; it's about the product, right? So, in my example of my career, it's not like the fact that I was traveling from Italy to Germany to Austria to the UK to France, etc. That made me international. It was the fact that I was interacting with people in these countries and I was managing a product which was available in all these countries simultaneously. So, essentially, the fact that you manage a product in multiple countries makes you an international product manager, and. And why is this relevant today? I Googled this data a couple of days ago. They might be changing because they change rapidly. If you think of the most successful and the products that you normally use on a daily basis, they are not products available only in these countries. They are all products available in multiple countries. Sometimes they actually go live simultaneously on day one in multiple countries, and that's the case of Netflix. I think they started going live essentially in 190 countries in one go. Obviously, there's a lot of preparation behind that. Facebook is available worldwide, apart from a couple of exceptions. YouTube, LinkedIn, Twitter, I don't know, because I tried to Google it, they're not telling us, but it's going to be a lot of countries anyway. Netflix, Airbnb, WhatsApp, Spotify, you name it. You know, it's all these products are available in multiple countries. So there is a common line of issues and things you need to solve when you want to launch a product internationally. Obviously, why today there is an opportunity for not just for tech giants, but also for new businesses, for startups to go and be available in not just in one country, is because the technology allows you to do so. There is a scalability offered by the technology that allows you to launch a product in multiple countries, not just in one. And that's possible also because usually organizations, they are structured in a way that they can support a business or a product that is not available only in one single country, but in multiple countries. How does this normally work? So in my experience, I mean, and that's not the case for all the big companies. My experience, as you have seen, it is based mainly with big organizations. Big organizations, and usually that's the setup of the company. You have a global team that normally sits in the headquarters. It can be anywhere the company is based. In my experience, in Vodafone, it was in the UK. In Samsung, it was in South Korea. In MasterCard, is in the US. And that is where the global team sits. And also the global product management team sits there. Then you have different regions split generally this way, but not necessarily. You have the US and Canada, you have Latin America, you have Europe, then you have Asia Pacific, Africa, and then you have Middle East. Mix them in a different way, and you're going to have possibly 5 regions, not 6. Possibly some country is in another region, but it doesn't really matter. And then within a region, you have possibly a set of countries where you are thinking of launching that product, right? So this is usually the setup of a big companies with international presence. If you see it in the global team, you are an international plant manager. If you see it in the regional team, you are an international plant manager. If you see it in a local team, you are not an international plant manager. You might be working on an international product, but you yourself are managing only locally that product. Now, I was saying that if you try and avoid the possibility of sitting alone in the dark crying because nobody's around you, you need to make friends. And obviously, as a product manager, you should try and make friends with your fellow product managers in the same office or in other offices, because they are, at the end of the day, the people who are going to give you the insights you need from a product point of view. And the fact is that, you know, in this type of organization, you're going to have best friends, which normally are the ones you fight the most. Then you have okay friends. And then you have what we call frenemies. They're not friends, they're not enemies. You need them, they need you. You don't like them, they don't like you. But it's okay. In my experience, usually it's this way. My best friends are the global people. And I've always been in a regional position. Well, I was in a global position at Vodafone, but it was bizarre. But anyway, so imagine you are in a regional position, so you're in the middle. The global guys are your best friends, are your best enemies, but you need to have them close, because they know the product possibly slightly better than you. They know the roadmap much better than you do. They are the ones that, in most occasions, giving you the green light to proceed in doing certain things. Sometimes they are the one you struggle the most with, but still they normally have the core insight on the product. So you're going to fight with them, but you have to love them a little bit. You have the okay friends, people in product managers in other regions. They are really important, and sometimes you need to try and sync up with them, because you might share issues, you might share lessons learned with them, you might share the same the same trouble, or you might share the same problem, and they have the solution for the problem. I've been pulled in calls with other regions because somebody was trying to do an implementation which was very similar to what I already implemented in Europe. They wanted to know how we did it. And you explain to them, so they don't need to reinvent the whole thing or do the same thing in a different way. So they are the okay friends. You don't fight with them, because you know nothing is. You know they don't expect you to solve their problems. But if you do, they're going to be your friends. And then you have the frenemies, and that definitely are the guys that works locally. Why they are your frenemies? Because in most occasions they think that you are fully dedicated to them, and you are not. You're not. You have possibly 7 countries. You have 8 hours in the office. You can't spend 1 hour per country and then 1 hour for coffees. You know, you can't. It doesn't work. So you need. Sometimes they don't understand that your time is limited to them. So they have to make the most out of the possibility of talking to you and grasping your attention and trying to understand how you can work together. And it doesn't mean that they are lazy. They work possibly more than you do. And in most occasions, while you're product managing one single product, they are product managing multiple products in one country. But the fact that there is a demand from these guys, which sometimes it goes beyond what you can give them. And in most occasions, they ask you something, you ask to the global guys, they say no. So you have to say no, and they don't like that no. So the equilibrium is very bizarre, but it is what it is. And this is, you know, it's my experience. It doesn't mean that your experience as a product manager is going to be the same. But, I mean, I've seen multiple situations where this kind of works this way. So we started with this conversation with the metaphor of building a car, and this exercise I'm doing now, it's very similar, right? But it's possibly closer to what I've been doing for the past many years in my experience. And what would you do when you're building a digital proposition? And it can be, once again, it can be you're building a platform for downloading contents, apps, games, music, streaming, video, whatever. Sorry. You don't start internationally. The company usually pick a country which is possibly for multiple reasons is the country where the product is possibly it's easier to be launched or easier to be successfully launched in that country. And let's imagine that you are starting this business in the UK, because the headquarter of the company is based in the UK, because your partners are based in the UK, because it's easier to meet with them on a daily basis and talk about business on that without, you know, issues with time zones and things like that. So you start the business in the UK. And then say, okay, we did it. It was successful. People like the product. What do? Shall we just expand to the next country? And normally what you do is, okay, let's go to Ireland. It's close. They speak English. In most occasions, the catalog is going to be the same catalog. You know, if it's about music, well, possibly some more folk music, but pretty much the same catalog. If it's movies, it's English, the language is the same. Okay, fine, easy. But then I say, okay, there's one problem. We have pounds, they have euros. You're selling something, so you need to make sure that what you're selling is actually sellable and people can buy that thing. Pricing is a very difficult thing. It's not just about translating a catalog in pound into a catalog in euros. You need to make sure that the pricing is right for that country. Something that is sold $9.99 in the UK possibly is too expensive at €9.99 in Ireland. Or maybe in Ireland there is already somebody selling that thing at €8, so you can't sell it at €9.99. Even if it would make sense, you can't do that. So it's not just simple as copy-paste UK into Ireland, that's it. No, it's not just painting the roof of the car with an Italian flag and just ship it. But then you do it. You understand that you need to change the price plan. You need to understand you need to do the pricing right. Okay, we did Ireland successful, so we have room to do another country. Let's go to Germany. It's big. I mean, people have money, so I think that's a huge opportunity there. Euro, we have euro. So, but no, once again, it's not like because you launch the product in Ireland, then you can sell the product the same price in Germany. Maybe $9.99 is too much for Ireland, but maybe it's too low for Germany. So you need to understand what is the right price for that new country. And then obviously, another obvious issue is they speak English, they speak German. So you need to localize this into something which is okay for the Germans. And it's not just about the language, it's also about the content. But once again, if it's movies, if it's books, if it's food, if it's whatever, you need to be localized, you need to be relevant to that country. And you do it because you understand that you have to do this, so you have localized this in German. And then you say, okay, next country is Switzerland. It's tiny. It's not going to be a problem. You know, it's a small country, so what's the problem there? Well, there's another currency, so you need to translate everything into another currency. And they speak three languages officially. Actually, I learned there is another language called how is it called? Romanish or... Yes, I don't know. Nobody really uses it, but actually, officially, there are four languages in Switzerland. Once I had to tell to the guy in Switzerland that he wanted some form of customization for languages based on geolocalization, depending on the canton where the user for the app should switch language automatically. I said, "Listen, mate, you have possibly more languages than customers. I don't think that requirement is actually something we're going to implement. So build the customer base first, give me a need, and then we will build the use case." But, you know, it's an example where, you know, once again, it's not just a matter of pricing. It's not just a matter of one language. It's a matter of multiple languages, and the content must be relevant.
If you have enjoyed the episode so far, check out our upcoming live events at productschool.com/events. Use the promo code PRODUCTPODCAST in all caps to get a free ticket to the next event in your city.
All these are challenges. And when I say challenges, I should possibly say opportunities. But somebody says that opportunities are risks, and I don't like the word risk. So I prefer to call them challenges. And that's how we're going to go through a set of challenges, which are possibly not all the challenges of this job, of this activity, but I think that possibly 80% of the challenges of this role of international product management are going to be listed there. And I start with something which is quite funny, but a couple of years, it was 2016, I was in Oxford Street by the Disney store, and I saw this. There was a new movie from Disney called Moana. Straight away with my Italian product manager way of thinking, say, there is no way, is there any Italian here? Right, okay, so you know what possible what I'm talking about, right? Okay, I said, there is no way this thing is going to be in Italy called Moana. So there is no way, they have to change it. And it's Disney, so they know they have to change it. In Italy, usually because we dubbed all the film, all the movies, movies arrive to the big screen a couple of months after they are released in the UK or in the US, right? So a couple of months after, the movie in Italy was Oceania. And so, obviously, it's like, there is no way that movie could have been called Moana. Why? Moana is not a very common name in Italy. It's not very common. But it was very famous in the 90s because there was the most famous porn star called Moana. I'm not kidding you not. Like, you know, it's, and possibly it's the only Moana that 99% of the Italians know. Not because everybody was watching porn movies in Italy, but because she was invited to talk shows. She was a very, you know, brilliant personality. She was famous, and then she disappeared. Nobody knows if she actually passed away or if she's still alive. Nobody. So it was, the whole thing was very, you know, significant in the life culture of Italians. You can't possibly call a movie for kids Moana. So they have to change it. They have to localize that to be something which was suitable to the. And I don't know if they change it for that reason. But I would possibly bet a huge amount of money. And they change the name into Oceania. And by the way, Moana in Maori means from the ocean, and Oceania means from the ocean. So it's not like they completely change, as they do sometimes in Italy. So you know, this is why localization matters. You can't go live with the product and you just crack a name for the product that doesn't work in the country, because people, nobody is going to go with the babies to the movies to watch Moana in Italy. Well, no, they won't. So, excuse me. So challenges, so opportunities, so risks. Localization. First thing first, I mean, localization is fundamental. You can't possibly think to be successful in a country where people don't understand what you're selling. If it's relevant, you need to translate it. If it's not relevant, you don't need to translate it. And when it's not relevant, if you're selling an app to learn English, possibly you don't need to translate the app from English to another language. Otherwise, you most likely want to translate at some point that application or that product. It is fundamental also in the way you interact with other people. That's why it's a challenge. It's not just what the final customer will see, but the way you interact with your peers, the way you interact with the global team, the way you interact with the local team. Getting lost in translation, it's so easy. After, I don't know how many years I've been working essentially in English, today I will send a mail with something which I didn't understand. I had to ask somebody, what does that mean? How was it? Catch 22? It was something that I had to Google it, what Catch 22 means. I didn't know. I think it was one of the first time I went to South Korea. I was supposed to be meeting with three girls I used to work with in a project. And I entered the room, and I've been emailing them for like a couple of months. So they write in English, I write in English, they reply in English, etc. So for me, they speak English, and I speak English. I enter the room. There is three girls and one boy. I say, okay, there must be somebody new to the team. I say, hi. I say, hi, Gerlando. Hi, I'm Hino. I'm here to translate. Essentially, those girls, they spoke English, but not good enough to be confident in interacting with me in English. So they wanted to have a Korean-American guy sitting there talking to me, and I was talking to him about something that he had no clue about, and he was translating this from English to Korean. And then they were replying in Korean, and he was translating back to me. Imagine how easy it is to get lost in translation there. So you need to make 100% sure that your message get across and that you understand what they're trying to say. But most importantly here, when building a product, is that your customer understand what you're building, what you're offering them. Otherwise, there is no way they will actually gonna use your product. User experience is fundamental. I was mentioning the situation of building a car or shipping a car which is suited for the UK market in Italy. You don't want people to get off the car, go all the way around, and just pick the ticket. I remember the first, in Vodafone, which we started building digital products in the initial smartphones. There was nothing like The user experience was heavily compromised by the fact that translating something from a language to another sometimes changes completely the real estate of the page of the phone. There are words which are very easy to, like in English, like buy. It's three letters. You need a small button, and you're good with it. But if you translate that buy into German, it's kaufen. And then in Spanish, it's comprar. In Italian, it's acquista. So it's going to be eight, I think, letters. So that button, which was small and you can place next to an image, it gets too big because you want the text to fit with the button, right? So there are small things that now possibly the way that the UX works is possibly much easier when one it adapts. So you, if you do this kind of thing, there is no way you're going to have a page completely redesigned. But like 10 years ago, it was complicated to translate things and make things meaningful to the customer without having a button on top of the image of the product you wanted to sell. That's not what you want to do. Relevant content. We say whatever is your business, whether it's, once again, you're selling food or books or music or movies, whatever you're selling, it has to be relevant to the country. You can't sell a catalog full of Indian movies in Italy because you're not going to sell that many. In the same way, you're not going to be able to sell Italian music in India the other way around. Or if you have a catalog with a lot of music for like from South America, maybe it works in Spain, but it's not going to work in Germany. So your content needs to be relevant. And that means we will see in another challenge that you need to have the right partnerships for that country. And then branding. The example of Moana with Oceania is that you can't just name something that works in English and in this country and you think, yeah, it's okay, we can launch it in the rest of the world. The name of the brand of the product has to be meaningful or has to be not meaningful at all in that country. But at least it does. You don't have the risk of calling Moana a movie for kids, right? Pricing. We've seen an example. You need to cater for different pricing. It's different currency. It means you need to build a different price plan. You need to understand what is your price positioning. And because, once again, if you're selling something for $10 in the US, it doesn't mean that you can sell the same product for £10 in the UK or €10 in Italy. You need to run an exercise. Possibly it's not just you running that exercise. There are different teams doing it, but you need to be mindful that is something that impacts your product. And then you need to cut for different. If you're selling something, how are people going to pay for it? In most occasions, you need to support things like PayPal, credit, debit cards, obviously now digital wallets. But in other countries, people pay with what they call airtime traffic. So they have prepaid money on their phone bill, and they use the phone bill to actually actually pay for content. And in that case, it's not just adding a button on a checkout page. You need to integrate that button with the provider of that technology. With aggregators, you need to be able to interact with these vendors and make sure that the timelines fits and you are offering to people the way to buy your product with the mean that they actually use most of the time. Competition. You might be very successful here because nobody's doing the same thing that you are doing, but you go locally and actually you have somebody already doing that in a different way, shape or form, but actually there is already a product there. So you need to be mindful of that, because in that case, you need to come with an idea of how your product is going to be different and which are your strengths and your weaknesses compared to the competition. Because if you don't do that exercise and you are second or third or fourth to the market, the risk is that actually you're not going to be successful because people stick to what they're using. If you're all using Spotify and I want to invent a brand new way for you to stream and listen to music, I need to create something which differentiates you because that is quite a powerful player to beat, right? So competition, it's very important. Market conditions. I said, and this is another key thing. Once again, if you're launching something in one country because you have the technology that supports that, you have the partnership to do that in this country, are you going to have the same partnerships in that other country? What I was referring to before, like when you build a catalog for music, for example, you need to have a contract with the majors, you know, with Warner, Universal, Sony, and EMI. But sometimes that partnership works only in the UK, so they give you a license to stream or to sell music in the UK and in Ireland. If you want to sell in Italy, you need to have another contract. Or initially, you need to cut for a contract with this major that works for all the region. And that works for anything, any kind of partnership. You partner with a bank, but that bank has a presence in multiple countries. You need to make sure that the contract is covering for that. Otherwise, you need to do another contract that takes into account all these things. Infrastructure. You're launching a product that requires something else to be available in the country. Once again, the examples I can bring on is when Vodafone was launching something about streaming content, but you can't stream content in certain countries with a mobile phone unless the mobile network supports that streaming. If there is no 4G, possibly there is not even 3G, you're not going to be able to launch that product, because obviously people can connect to Wi-Fi, etc. But you, as a standalone provider, you need to be able to tell customer, buy my phone, buy this tariff, you can stream content using my network. You can't just rely on the fact that somebody is going to connect to a Wi-Fi hotspot at some point and they will be able to stream the content. And that applies to anything. I used to work at Samsung for Samsung Pay. We needed an underlying piece of technology provided by Visa, MasterCard, and Amex called tokenization. And at the beginning, tokenization, which essentially means translating your credit card information into a token that is going to sit on the device and will be used on behalf of your card number, that tokenization platform was not available beyond the UK. So even if Samsung wanted to launch that product in other countries, they had to wait or find alternatives, possibly more complicated, to launch that product in other countries, unless Visa and MasterCard and Amex, they would have brought tokenization into those countries. So you need to be mindful of these things. What is the underlying technology which is not part of what you're building that has to be there for your product to be available there? And obviously, consumer behavior, consumer needs. The fact that people do certain things in country number one, it doesn't mean that people in country number two will do the same things. Once again, the example I had, like from Samsung Pay, is are people using cards? Because if you go in a country where people are not using cards, why do you want to build something which is possibly the step after using a card, which is a mobile wallet? Or do people actually use mobile wallets? Or do people have the money to buy a smartphone that supports the technology? Because if they don't have a smartphone, if they don't have the latest Apple or Samsung device, you can't build a piece of product that is not going to be used by the customers. And more challenges, regulations. The example of the car with the headlights. In most cases, you need to be mindful of what are the local laws, what are the regional laws or the international laws that actually might give you opportunities, but might give you also the possibility of not being able to do things the way you wanted to do things. Everybody knows about like GDPR. I think it was March or April where everybody received like tons of emails about, oh, we are modifying the law. La, la. What does it mean? It's a mess. It's messy. And you have a lot of team of legal people understanding what it means for customer-facing products. And you as a product manager, you need to be mindful for that. You need to be mindful of that. Distance and time zone. That is one of the biggest challenges. The fact that you are not talking to people face-to-face. The interactions with the people you are talking to are, in most occasions, on the phone or via emails. And it's so easy to get angry with people you don't see in their faces. You don't see them as human beings. You see them as colleagues, and that's it. That's why they become frenemies. The best way to overcome that is to go and meet them for once, have a beer, have lunch, have dinner, and they become human beings. And they will possibly disappoint you at some point, but you still see them as human beings, and they see you as a human. Even if you're tough, even if you are possibly stubborn, but they see you as a person. and it's complicated. It's difficult. And coordinating work activities is not easy. Because possibly you wake up at 7 for a conference call when it's midnight in California and somebody else is kind of 5 p.m. they want to leave the office in Southeast Asia. And you need to try and coordinate this because you need people attending that call based in San Francisco, but you need somebody else who is based in South Korea, and you need somebody else who is based in Europe. So it is a challenge. It is a challenge to coordinate these kind of things. But there can be also technical challenges. I remember like once we had to implement something in Russia, which was a kind of a promotion starting at midnight of day one and ending at midnight of day 7. You say, well, okay, that's okay if you have one time zone. In Russia, you have 11 time zones. So, okay, midnight of what? Which one? It's like, well, go for Moscow. It's like, not really, because actually the whole thing, it has to be midnight by law, once again, the law, in the place where the country was. So it was a huge challenge, and we had quote from some of the providers, which was crazy money, because they had to implement some piece of technology which was allowing customers to buy something from midnight in the place where they were in that time zone in Russia. So time zone can be quite a significant challenge as well. And more challenges, but that is the last one. It's the last two pieces. One is the culture. Obviously, it is kind of relatively easy in Europe. But there are differences between being in the UK or being British and being from Southern Europe. But it is significant, but it's not that significant when you actually are dealing with people based in completely different regions. But still, you need to be mindful of what the culture of the end customer is and what is the culture of your peers, of your product managers in other countries. I explained the situation where I was talking to somebody speaking in English, who was translating in Korean and then translating back from Korean to English back to me. And the risk of misunderstanding, the risk of miscommunication is really high. But you need to be able to actually fact check everything once, twice, three times to make sure that the message is going across. And sometimes you need to make phone calls, sometimes you need to send emails, sometimes you need to go on Skype, sometimes you need to find a way to do that. Right? And it's obviously this fundamental to know the culture of the customers and to know the culture of the other people. Once again, like the example of working for a company with a very different background, like a Samsung Electronics with a South Korean background, it told me a lot. In most occasions, they give you the example of the iceberg. What you see of the Koreans is just the tip of the iceberg. But there is a lot which goes underwater that you as a non-Korean, you don't see, but you need to be mindful of. In terms of respecting certain hierarchies, in terms of respecting the way they approach a meeting. We do a meeting here most of the times to exchange information, to just say, oh, I think this way, oh, I think this way, oh, what about this, what about... It doesn't matter if in the meeting there is, possibly, an executive VP, a very senior person in the team. Everybody contributes to that. In that case, in most occasions, the meeting was called just to have a VP saying what he thought. And that's it. It's not interactive. It's not like, oh, but I think that's wrong. No, that's not why they do anything. We might find this different. We might not like it. But that's the way they did. And that's the way, in most occasions, they do. And what do you do? You need to understand, well, if you disagree with that, if you think that you have some data telling you that's not the right thing, you need to find a way to communicate that in a different way, which is not in that meeting. You possibly exit the room, you try and have a chat with him, or try to be introduced by him, by somebody else, and you discuss with the guy. Last one is the difference between global versus local. Once again, and possibly the last point is the most relevant one. You in a let's say more global position compared to a local guy, you need to be mindful of the local requirements are relevant, but the backlog is global. So there is a lot of requirements that have to be fulfilled, and your simple local needs might not fit into this sprint. It might go to the next one, or it might go to the next one, or maybe we'll never go live because from my global point of view, we don't think that is relevant. We don't think that is relevant, not even for your country. So unless you justify why you want that requirement to be surfacing into the product, we're not going to do it. Because it's expensive, we have better things to do. Right, so with these challenges in mind, let's go to the next step. You possibly have seen this. That's not something that I invented, obviously. This is from Eric Nieberg in Crisp's blog. His famous picture that explains in a quite significant and useful way the concept of building an MVP, minimum viable product, and the iterative delivery. So you iterate the delivery in a way that is meaningful. On the you can go to his blog and actually read the way, because at some point you had to explain what he thought about it, because obviously everybody said, oh, this is too, no, that's not the reality of things, that is another metaphor. I don't know why whenever there is a car there is a metaphor, but the reality is that is not building a car, that is building any product. And the upper line is wrong, because you have somebody asking you to get them a car, and if you give them just a tire, they're going to say, what do I do with a tire? If you give them like two tires, it's like, what do I do with the two tires? Up until the end, the customer is not going to be happy. But it's not going to be happy in a way that it's not going to give you any feedback about it. Like, I'm not happy because you're giving me something which is absolutely useless to me. So what do I do with this thing? Right? So that's not helpful at all. The second approach downstairs is a completely different approach. So you start analyzing what is the actual customer needs. The customer needs to go from point A to point B. That's the final need. So that's why he wants a car, because he wants to go from A to B. So, okay, we will get there, but in the meantime, I can give you a skateboard. And actually, before the skateboard, I can give you a bus ticket. Obviously, it's not a car, but you want to go from A to B. So I give a bus ticket, and you tell me, well, but that's not what I want to do, because it's parked, because the bus stop is too far away. Fine, he is giving you feedback. And you build what is called the MVP, based on the feedback of the customer. And you give them a skateboard. And he's not happy about the skateboard. Why? Because possibly he doesn't feel safe. It's not stable enough. Say, okay, it's not stable enough. Okay, so I build, like, you know, with the steering thing, possibly it's going to be a little bit more stable. And then you build something else, which is a bike. And he's getting slightly less disappointed. And maybe he discovers that, you know, when you get me to the motorbike, I actually like the feeling of breeze on my face. So when I get to the car, actually I'm building a cabrio, because he's giving me a feedback about he likes the breeze in the face. So I'm not giving this car, which possibly that's what he wanted, but actually he realized himself or herself that she would like a cabrio. So I deliver a cabrio. And that is the concept of building an MVP. And at all these stages, this is an MVP, this is an MVP, this is an MVP, this is an MVP, and this is an MVP. Every single time you iterate the MVP and you add pieces of feedback that are coming from the customers. And that's how you do. And that's very likely that this customer is going to be happy, because he has been contributing to building the final car. It's possibly not very likely that this guy is actually smiling there, because possibly after 3 years they say, well, you know, I even forgot I wanted a car. I mean, I'm doing something else. I'm just getting an Uber, so I don't need a car anymore. So it's likely that this guy is not going to be happy. So this is a concept that applies, obviously, to international product management, because this is an agile concept that is applies to everything. The question is, from an international point of view, what you need to put to build the MVP? What are the things you need to consider to build the MVP? And the MVP, once again, it gives you the possibility to have something available to the customers. And sometimes customers is a word that is used not necessarily to be referring to real customers. It can be what we call friends and family. It means you distribute the product internally within the company, or you actually bring it back home and you make it, your real friends and family use it, test it, and giving you feedback. So the question is, what do you need to consider when building the MVP? This picture is another kind of famous image. It's called the build, measure, learn feedback loop. And the tricky thing is that being a loop, you don't know whether the first thing you have to do is build, measure, or learn, but it's a loop. So at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, because you will go into loop. So in most occasions, you have to build something first, but possibly the first thing you do is you have learned something from somewhere else that makes you build the first thing first in any case. So And build itself is something that is, it comprises, you have to design something, you have to build something, and then you have to run something. And that's okay, that's how you build the first thing, and you make sure that you have built something, and what can you factor of all the things we've been talking to tonight? You need to understand what are the key localizations. These are the ones that have to be in your MVP. If you're releasing something to customers, and once again, it's something that has been built in Korean, and you release this in Europe, nobody will understand. Sometimes I still see a few occasions where there is a mismatch of text in our apps. I say, well, somebody forgot to translate this page. That's what you possibly will want to avoid. You want to be customers, once again, to understand what you're saying. The pricing has to be right. You can't release something if the price is not correct. You need to be mindful of the competition. You need to have a benchmark there. You need to be some research, trying to understand who is available in the market, who is not available in the market doing the same thing. So understand the market conditions, what available partnerships there are, and if there is the infrastructure that is actually fostering your product in that country. And then obviously you can't get away not knowing the regulations, and you need to understand the culture of that country. So these usually are the key elements of the MVP. And once again, that's not just to build a skateboard. That is, every time you iterate that process, you need to be considering these things. Obviously, if you have done the localization already of the language, you can only add the piece of localization that it was missing with the new iteration. But still, you need to be mindful of all these things. And then what do? Then you have to measure. So you release this, you give it to the public, or to the customers, or to the friends and family, and you ask them, do you like it? What do you like it? Why don't you like it? In the example of the car and the skateboard, at some point the guy says, what if the feedback is, well, I don't like the skateboard because it's blue. It's like, is that it? Yes, I don't like blue. I just want it red. Okay, you don't need to build a car. He's happy. He just wanted a red skateboard. And that's it. So you saved a lot of money. You don't need to actually have the whole production line of a car. You can get away with a blue skateboard. So the feedback is fundamental. And how you build it, you need to measure the data. You need to ask customers. You need to have user groups. You possibly need to do some A/B testing to understand if some feature is more relevant than some other feature. And then you need to understand if you are hitting the performances that you are, that the business is asking you to achieve. The business is launching a product because they want to achieve something, which is number of users, how much money you can make out of this application, and then you need to measure this. And if something out of the measurement is not right, you need to be able to pivot something. Because once you've done the measurement, you can keep doing what you're doing. So you say, okay, you can persevere because everything looks okay, or you need to be able to pivot something. So you need to be able to change something, otherwise the feedback you keep getting from the customer is that they don't like the product. So if they don't like the product, you need to be able to change the product in a way that is meaningful to you. Right. Final note, I mean, it's something else which applies to product management, to international product management, definitely. And it's, in most occasions, you will be told, and there are companies that actually, they in their manifesto, they say, well, you know, the customer is the main driver of your job. You can't, you as a product, you never say, well, I like this feature because I think is fundamental. You need to be mindful of who is going to be the customer. You can't think for yourself. You need to be thinking because the customers will be liking this feature, will be not liking this feature. So you will be thought, you know, as a product manager, you will be the advocate for the customer, and it's the CEO telling you. So build the product based on what you think is going to be right for the customer. At some point, they will come back to you and say, well, you know, we had something, we didn't know whether we wanted to go A or B, and thanks for telling me that 90% of the customers will like to have A, but you know, my kids are actually going for B, so we go B. And who is saying that? It's the same CEO. So you know, sometimes it's just like, what I'm going to mean, it's like, you told me that the customer is king, and now you're telling me, well, we don't care about the customer because, you know, whatever reason, which is absolutely non-meaningful to you, we have to go another way. And you don't like that. Because once again, it's not because you felt empowered by that thing, but simply because, you know, you think you have the data that shows you that customers want that. And if you don't do that, that is your product. Yes, he's the CEO. Maybe he has 500 billion other things to do, but you want that product to be successful, right? Does it apply to international product manager? Yes, it does. So what do you do in this case? You have two options there, no more than two options. So one is you accept the situation, and you say, well, okay, he's the CEO. He must be the CEO for some reason. Possibly he's right. I don't like the reasoning of that, so you accept it. Or you do something else. I mean, you have, once again, the data, and you need to be able to do something, which is, you know, and today is football night, so as a football fan, like, you need to be able to turn your worst enemies into your best friends. You need to loop with them. You need to find a way to break through these guys, and you need to find a way to actually make the CEO say, well, you were right, we have to go A, because you have the power to tell the CEO, well, you're wrong because of this and this. You have the data telling you that something that he thinks he could have been right, he was actually wrong. And you need to be, sometimes not arrogant, but you need to be to stand by your points. Once again, he's the CEO, so if he decides that's not the right thing to do, I mean, there's not much you can do. Apart from the consolation of 3 months after that, the guy comes back to you and says, well, you were right. I say, okay, well, I knew it. But, you know, once again, he's the CEO, so you can't say much about it. Okay, guys, that was my last slide for tonight, and I hope you enjoyed this presentation.
Thanks for listening to the Product Podcast. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. If you want to know more about our courses and next course, visit productschool.com. Stay tuned for the next episode to learn more about the secrets in product management.